Recording.
All right, so welcome. Today we'll talk about tree-based algorithms and neural net-based algorithms. The first in the first half and the second half of today, the neural nets. So for now, we'll focus on tree-based algorithms. And these are sort of the, let's say, the foundation of it all, along with neural networks. So for that, let me start sharing. And first I want to start with an example just to get our line of thought in place, and then I'll talk about decision trees in general. So here is a discussion of a case where the idea is that given data about housing, can you determine the price at which a house or an apartment will be sold? All right. So, well, the data here is 50,000 real estate sales. And they include, of course, the final sales price, which is the target. Hence, we're in regression now. We could also use this for saying, should we categorize it as an apartment or a house? But this we already know, so that wouldn't bring much new. Perhaps more interesting, we could categorize it as will be sold within 3 months. But for now, it's the sales price we're looking at. And then we have all the input descriptive feature value variables. Notice how this has many words. Input variables, and I would say feature variables or descriptive variables, and we usually denote that by X, capital X, and that's a vector. And then the target, which might either be a category or a sales price, we give the, well, the we call that capital Y. And so of course the goal is to determine the final sales price as accurately as possible. Now note already, as accurately is not a well-determined measure. And this we'll, of course, discuss. And while the data is on the border of big data, we've chosen to use it here because, well, 50,000 is big enough that you won't be doing it manually. And, well, it's a size that will, which your computer will eat in a finite time. So the development time is fast. And we have this data set. It's not what we're going to play with today, but we might play with this at some point. So here are all the input feature variables. And I'm not going to go through them in great detail, but you know, things like postal code, sales price, sale date, taxation value of the plot, the address, the floor number, size indoor, size outdoor, things like that. All right, so how about that? Well, as it turns out, not all of these are available. So there are 90 pieces of information for each property, but as it turns out, many of them are empty. So if you insist on all of them being there, then, well, the fraction of, for which the information is there is shown in the top right. And in the next one is, well, if I start insisting on what information should be there, then how fast do I decrease the amount of data I have?
Tools.
Of course, I want the price paid and the address and the postal codes. But indoor size already.
I think you're on the wrong slide.
Sales date, condition, sales price, size outside, taxation plot, floor number. Whoa, I lost. I don't know. 95% of my data. Okay. What can I do? I can perhaps use a method which will allow me to not have the information. And typically in data files, you might assign it the value -999. You might do something else.
Tools.
We'll also get to that. But as it turns out, tree-based algorithms are good at this type of categorical data because, well, as we shall see, they can just divide on that. So here is what is required, and that leaves 50% of the data, which I think is a fair choice, but it could be done simpler. It's just what I've done in the following. And then I also, you know, one thing we're going to stress throughout this course is the fact that whenever you get data, don't start by trying a machine learning algorithm on it. You might, and then it runs in the background. But if you don't plot your data and look at it in, you know, quite some detail, things are going to go horribly wrong, or at least you're not going to get the most efficient result. Right. So, for example, here the average price over a 20-year period, and this seems almost flat. Well, surely they have then corrected for inflation and rising of prices, because otherwise it wouldn't really look bad. But you might not know that about data. Then we tried to plot things per square meter. You know, what's the what do you get there? And here you see that there are some extreme outliers, right? There's one place which paid 100 million for something which is 70 square meter in the first plot, bottom right corner. All right, 100 million for 70 square meters. Not even in central London with a view would you pay that. So something, it seems that there's a natural limit to size and price paid. So, and when you look closer, well, then there's a relation. Ah, I'm being told that my slides don't shift. Is that correct?
Yes, and we've also tried to say something in the chat and also try to say something by unmuting.
Well, I'm not muted.
Can you hear us, Tools?
Yeah, yeah, I hear you fine.
Okay, we tried to say something during during your presentation, but it seemed like you didn't hear us at all.
It was just turned low. Sorry about that. But the slides are not changing, you're saying?
No, we could only see the first slide.
Aha. All right. Well, the good thing is they're all posted, but that still worries me a bit. Do you see that I'm stopped sharing now?
Yes.
All right. And if I share screen again, do you see a different slide than the first one now?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
Okay. You still see it? Do you see that I go forward now?
No, you're on slide 8 and it doesn't change from slide number 8.
Okay. Does it change now when I do this?
Yes.
All right. Then I'll have to do it like that. All right. Well, to summarize real quick, we have a bunch of feature variables which we want to inspect. And so that's why you should always, always plot things. Here, I just did a check of, for example, I did a linear fit here just saying, is there a linear relation between the price paid and the size? Unfortunately, there is. Good. You know, but sometimes you might get a negative curve here, and then you have something to understand. All right. Well, plotting the price paid per indoor square meter looks like this. And that seems reasonable, but if I look at it on a grander scale, then it actually has some extreme outliers. So we've decided that you won't pay more than a million. We don't know who paid that, but that's not a normal value. And also less than 100 crowns per square meter sounds strange. So those we cut out. Okay. And then here, there's a value called condition 1 to 6. And I don't know what that is, but hopefully it's something with condition, but I want to check that. So here I just tried to say, well, what's the price paid and what's the indoor area? And then try to fit that for each. But actually it's when you plot it that you realize that condition one is the best, right? There is no, you can't get anything below a million if it's in condition one, even if it's smallish. And then it moves downward in price with condition. All right, so condition one is best. Then inspecting further, you can see that the price per square meter for each category is also highest for one. So that seems to suggest that that's right. What would you do if you did not have a machine learning algorithm and you wanted to build sort of a way of getting an idea? Well, here I tried to just say, let me restrict ourselves to Østerbro postal code 2100 and plot things. And suddenly I see a much nicer linear relation. In fact, I could fit each of them with a line and get something which is in fact not, you know, completely off. Then I can compare, for example, to Nørrebro and Amager, 2200 and 2300. And I still see the nice linear relation. I also see a few outliers in each of these. But I see especially a distribution in the price paid. Well, that reflects the indoor area because Amager has a lot of apartments which are 60 square meters. So does Nørrebro, whereas Østerbro has some, but you know, probably a little higher on average. And the square meter price is also different between Amager and Nørrebro and Østerbro. So that means postal code needs to be taken into account. We'll return to that. And then the price versus the floor. So if it's apartment, it turns out the price paid just increases depending on what floor you're on. And I spoke to a real estate agent. He said, yeah, there's a reasonable relation there simply because people want more light. But he said it depends a lot. For example, with an elevator, then it's much sharper. And without an elevator, it's not. It depends on area. And slowly you put together something. And here is then where I tried to use this, my super simple non-machine learning algorithm, to just show, well, what do I get? And for, well, what is quite normal in regression is to plot the estimate that you come with minus the price divided by the price. So that's the relative accuracy, you could say. And I'm glad to see that it's a distribution which is a peak around zero. That means I'm not completely off. And well, the mean is 15% off, so I'm not too happy nor proud. However, I could easily just add 15% to all my estimates and then that would become zero. But the root mean square error here, a standard deviation, is not that great. I have a 27% uncertainty, which must be said to be high. But I shouldn't expect to get it perfect, even with a machine learning algorithm and all the information in the world, because it depends also if you have the right buyer at the right time. So there's an inherent uncertainty in it. And now, where do I go from here? Well, my estimate is too high, but I mean, continuing doing it this way is just, well, not a path forward. Because the model gets more and more complicated to update and improve. And there's no system by which I can improve the model. Yeah, I can include one variable at a time and correct for that, but it's not really a system. The process is also very manpower intensive. And in this world, not the least Denmark these days, manpower is what costs money. So this is not the way forward. And of course, the solution is a machine learning algorithm, multivariate analysis, and you want to make predictions. And already now, I'd love to go back to, I'm going to stop sharing around page 18. And I would love you to vote. Do you think this problem of regression for this data set is solved best by a tree-based analysis or a neural network-based analysis? And those with tree-based say yes, and those with neural net say no. So is this solved best with a tree-based analysis? Please think also, and actually, this is a time where, you know, I would ask you to discuss with the person next to you. If you can do that here, then that would be great. But please consider for a minute or two. And we'll get to the there's the breakout rooms. That's right. We didn't consider that because it does it by random. But actually, this might be the good place for doing it. All right, so we're breaking out, and we are breaking out into, 48 participants. That means we'll put 16 in each, 3 per room. Creating a breakout room now, and you've got 1 minute. All right, 20 seconds more. Please finish your discussions. All right. Okay. Yeah. Coming back, I can't. All right, the breakout rooms will end in 40 seconds. They always get a minute, I can see. But now I would like in plenum to discuss what reasons people have for thinking one or the other. All right. So who thinks the tree-based algorithm is good and why? Uh, Yeah. We're closing the breakout rooms and discussing. And Jonathan, please.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I was thinking that in the same way as we did yesterday, you could look at each variable and find a good separation criterion or what?
Yeah, but do you think a tree-based algorithm or a neural network-based algorithm is going to be the best?
Yeah, I think the tree.
The tree? And why?
I don't think I understand them enough to give a good explanation, but I was thinking that it's possible to do it the same way we did yesterday, right? Like find a good separation criterion for a specific target value or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that would be at least the way it was possible to do it. So,
okay. Haider?
So, I mean, it depends on what exactly the criteria for success is. If it's just fitting it to the training data, then neural networks can always, within any error, find a solution that fits it for any given error. So it would be a neural network.
All right. Well, first of all, I'm going to ask you, within any given error, if I understand you correctly, then you would say it can get it within one crown. But remember, it has to work on the test set. And the tree-based can also get on the training set the perfect score. Right?
Can I... I don't...
Yeah? Jan?
I was considering the... that the tree-based method can work better if, depending on the type of variables we have, if they are like discrete variables, may work perfectly. I haven't checked that in detail that the variables, the features, descriptive variables we have now, but I guess it would have to do with the type of variables.
Cool, Jan, please remember to raise your hand.
Sorry about that.
No worries. Aske? Yeah?
Yes, I was thinking that since the market changes quite a lot, or at least somewhat, that there would have to be some retraining being done, and that's just easier on a tree-based solution because it's rather fast to train. So I was thinking maybe doing it on a tree base is a bit simpler, and I think the data does seem to fit how a tree-based model would work.
Okay, thank you. Rasmus?
Yeah, I think I'm in favor of the neural network due to the fact that I would suspect the data having a lot of like non-linear relationships. And like from the exercise we did yesterday, unless you do something that is super complicated, your trees will always be like quite linear, where it's easier to, or at least by my understanding, it's easier to capture a nonlinear relationship in a neural network.
That's actually not the case. The tree-based algorithms are perfectly good at getting the nonlinearities. And in fact, when they're really, really complicated, sometimes it's better at it. But they can both do that. So that's not an argument for the neural network-based. All right, Sven.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Awesome. I just wanted to test my new microphone.
All right. Christopher, and then Sofus, and then we'll end. Christopher?
So, can you hear me now? Okay. Yeah. I was thinking like you showed the data and it seemed like there was like systems within the different postal codes, like pretty nice systems, linear systems. So maybe it's good to have a tree that divides it into postal codes, for instance. And then work on those systems rather than mixing it all together, what the neural network might do. And I think it might also be easier to read from the tree what actually affects the price.
Yeah, cool, good point. And Sophus, at the end?
Yeah, I would think, like, this is just a bit of a naive way of thinking of it, but I think the housing prices contains a bunch of, like, yes and no questions, which the tree-based algorithm seems pretty good at. Like, is it on a high floor? Is it in that region of the world? Is it, like, a bunch of yes and no questions, which seems pretty good for a tree-based algorithm?
I agree on it, except that neither floor nor place is a yes and no thing, but...
I mean a high or a low floor. Like, is it high up or is it low down?
Yeah. All right. Well, to round the discussion, I would generally say the fact that it's discrete, categorical, is something that points towards the tree and also the missing values. Because if you in a tree put floor 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe a few 6, 7s, and minus 999 when the information is not available, then the tree is very good at cutting at minus 1, for example, and saying, all right, those I have for and those I don't have for, and continue down. The neural network has a hard time dealing with that. The other thing is the postal code, that dividing on that is actually quite powerful. And you can divide into regions with that until you don't need it anymore. So let's continue now with decision trees in general, and complain loud and immediately if you don't see the slides shifting as you would expect them to. Do you all see them?
Yes.
All right. Well, so this is on decision trees, and I would say, see, if you build one decision tree, that means you just have a bunch of questions and at the end you have boxes. And while this is very transparent and very simple, it's rarely the most performant thing to do. And I would say that files under more what I would say machine learning in an academic sense than in an industrial sense, because it's not very performant. It doesn't give the right answers very often, and it often doesn't generalize that well. So that's why we typically talk about boosted decision trees or random forest. And what that is, we'll go to. But here's a quote from Trevor Hasty. He's not only the main author of the book that we recommended, but he's also he's a professor of mathematics and statistics at Stanford, and he's one of the leading figures in machine learning, I would say. So, but he says, tree learning comes closest to meeting the requirements for serving as an off-the-shelf procedure for data mining. Okay, because it's invariant under scaling and various other transformations of feature values. So you can take the feature values, the input values, and multiply them by your phone number and subtract, the distance from here to Paris. They don't care. They don't care what the values represent. They just cut on them and keep doing so. And they're also robust to discontinuous categorical data or irrelevant features. So let's say in the feature list, I put in, for example, the phone number of the seller and the, I was going to say the temperature of the day, but who knows, that could actually have an influence. But maybe I just put in a random number. And that might confuse the algorithm. But trees are quite good at dealing with that sort of noise and confusion. And that has to do with how it decides where to make the decision. And then it produces inspectable models. Somebody alluded to that also in the discussion we just had. I would say that's true for a decision tree, but in the way it's used in modern days, it's not true. Because as we shall see, when you build 100 trees and have them vote in a weighted way, that's not really inspectable, right? You're not going to sit and look at 100 trees and see if that makes sense or not. So I would say the third point is perhaps the culprit here. However, they are seldom accurate, which means most performant. And this, I would say, perhaps so, but it's not super clear that it's not so. For some cases, they might be the most accurate. But I'd say for continuous data, lately, neural networks have seemed to push it just a little bit further. All right, so let's go and look at a decision tree. And as I wrote, it works for 95% of all problems. Maybe I'm pushing it there. It works for 95% of all problems where the data is structured, meaning you come with a single entry, property for sale, and you have a fixed number of numerical, well, it doesn't have to be numerical, values in. But notice the fixed number, which means generally things that fits in an Excel sheet. For that, they're very good. And they fully use nonlinear correlations. They typically, well, everybody likes a lot of data to train on, and they are sensitive to overtraining. We'll get to what that is from. So here is, for example, a decision tree that starts by making that cut. And then over here, it makes this cut, because now it gets a clean sample. And for the remains, it makes this cut. And over here, it made that cut, and then that cut. And it doesn't have to change the variable that it cuts on. It can cut on the same variable again. Now, in this way, you could make one single decision tree. But one of the things that made decision trees performant was the idea of boosting. And what you do is that you say, well, I introduce a weight to the each event depending on whether you got it right or wrong in the first go. And then you rerun again. And the idea is from 97 with something called AdaBoost, but you know, once ideas like that are out, people grab them immediately and make their own algorithms that are smarter and better and more fit and so on. And then you simply rerun, increasing the weight of the misclassified entries. That means the next tree will be different and will focus on those who got wrong in the first go. But it remembers the first tree still because it says, well, that was good overall. And then you get something that focuses on the general problem, but also those that were hard. And then it focuses more and more so. And so here's boosting illustrated. This is from Wikipedia. It's a very simple illustration. You have the original data. Let me just ask you, can you see my arrow pointing also?
Yes.
Good. Excellent. You have the original data, and then you build a classifier at decision tree, and it gets some right and it gets some wrong. And then you could say that it puts the wrong back in with a certain weight, so there are more of those, right? You can either repeat the same event or change its weight. Notice there's nothing wrong in saying, I'm gonna, this is a case it should learn a lot from, I'll include it twice. Right? You could just do that. There's nothing forbidding that. And then you run again and again and again. And in the end, you make what's called an ensemble classifier, which means you take all the classifiers you had, all the trees, and then you let them vote or do something else that collects it into one answer. Okay? So that's the idea of boosting. Where do you split? Well, here we come to the idea of a loss function. We'll talk much more of that. So how does the algorithm decide on which variable to split and where to split? Well, in general, there are several ways this can be done. And it's also different between classification and regression. But in general, you'd like to make a split where you maximize the improvement gained by doing so. All right, how do I define improvement? Well, in classification, one often uses the average cross entropy loss. Okay, that sounded, well, what is that? It's also called the log loss. And well, why entropy? Where does that come from? Well, if you can divide the sample into two, where one is overwhelmingly signal, one class, and the other is overwhelmingly background, another class, well, then you lowered the entropy because it's more ordered. So what's the cross entropy? Well, let's look at this expression here. Well, there's an average here. Okay, that's good. Yn is the truth category of the nth entry, right? So 0, 1. And y hat n is our estimate of that, right? So this is a number between 0 and 1, essentially saying how confident are we that this is either one or the other. So if you have 0.000001, then you're pretty confident that that was a 0. And if you have 0.999999, you're pretty confident that that was a 1. Now, if you calculate this, let's say this is a 0, all right? Well, if you get that value close to 0, then the log of it is a big number, but you multiply it by 0, so that's okay. This still gives 0. And over here, you have 1 minus 0, so this is now a 1. And you have 1 minus, and this number was very close to 0, so you have 0.99999 here. You take the log of it, and that becomes very close to 0, which means you add very little to the loss function when you're right. If you're wrong, then this is 0, but you were guessing something close to 1 here. 0 times something close to 0 is still 0. But over here, you say 1 minus 0, well, that's 1. And here you had a number that was close to 1, which means you get 1 minus close to 1. That's close to 0. And the log of that is suddenly a sizable number times 1. Now you add to the loss function. So it's better to be right. So this is actually an example of the term that you want to minimize when you're done. When you're asking a model, how good are you? You calculate this. And in this way, you say, where do I make the split? Well, how about running through all variables and all possible splits? And of course, there are algorithms for doing this fast and so on. And then you ask, where do I take a step down in log loss when I split? And where I get the biggest, I split there. There are many other ways of doing it. There's something called Gini coefficients. You can also just say the variance within each category should be reduced. We can even say, well, the chi-square, if I say a fixed number in each category, should, you know, decrease. But actually in classification, this has become sort of the standard way of doing it, admittedly. All right, let's try that on the housing data. What's going on there? Well, here is one of the decision trees in the housing data that we just looked at. And what does it do? Well, it looks at the size of the house and asks, are you less than 462 square meters? And the sample is 7,000. Why is it not 50,000? Well, that's because we trained on most of the data and we evaluate in the end on a smaller fraction. And then it says, all right, well, how many houses are more than 462 square meters? Well, it turns out that most are smaller than that and 28 are bigger. And then it asks if the construction year over here is before 1812. And if it's smaller, if it's before that, well, then there's only one left. And it the guess is that it was sold at 7.4 million crowns. Okay, what went on here? Well, it turned out that it probably had an outlier, this one. And it said, well, I get a great increase in how well I can do things if I just start by taking those out and making a special case out of those. And then you might say, okay, but hey, you ended up in a place where you just had one entry in the last one. This is one of the parameters you can set for the algorithm, that you don't allow, what is the minimal number you allow here? Well, in this case, it was one. Well, that works well on the training data, but it's not certain that it works well on the validation data, necessarily. And the other 27 were out here, and they will ask more questions about that. What about the other way? Well, then it asks about the postal code. Is it less than 3,100? That's just to ask if it's in the Copenhagen area or not. All right, most of these are not within Copenhagen. Of course, it's all of Denmark. Then it asks if the house is less than some amount. It asks about the house size again here. Here it says school distance, construction year, supermarket distance, size of house. Here it asks postal code again. And actually, as you can see, it's not even finished when it's down here. It just continues down. It's inspectable, but if you have 100 of those, I would say it's at the very, very verge of inspectable. Okay? You can also try to see another one here, where it says, well, I ask about postal code, then house, then postal code, then size of house, then postal code. All right, you get a sense for which variables are important, postal code and size of house. Well, that's not strange at all. This is a decision tree where it's categorical because, well, where we're trying classification, because here the question is rather, will the house be sold for more or less than 2 million crowns? Maybe the banks want to evaluate, for all those who borrowed 2 million, are they actually insolvent or not? I don't know who are asking the questions. We don't care. But then, of course, everything changes here. Then a little bit about cross-validation. I'm just going to mention it, and we will return to it in general. The thing is, here's your data sample. All right, and you want to split that into actually three sections. So this has already been split out here is your test sample. So when you're done and finished with the algorithm and you're satisfied with the result, you tried on the test data, which means data you've never seen before. And then for the rest, you want to divide it into two. Because you want to say, I'm going to train on some of it, and then I'm going to see how well it does on the remaining part, the validation. And then I'm going to change things, weights, make a new tree, whatever I'm going to do. And then I'm going to look at the validation again and see if I improved. And when I'm not improving any longer, well, then I should probably stop. But it turns out that you can actually do it in this smart way where you say, well, I'm going to divide it into k-folds. So let's say that you divide it into six parts. You train on the five, and then you validate on the sixth. And you do that again and again and again, and in the end, you have a result. And now you repeat it, but now you train on five others, and you validate on the last one. And this way, you can, and this is done when you have little data, because now you can train on all of the data available here, and you can test it on most of it. So that's nice. Of course, it's CPU intensive because you're repeating it k times. All right, let's move on to random forest. Well, let's mention a few problems that we have here in this booster. When you vote across here in the ensemble classifier, well, I'm going to ask you, now, do you think that there's a correlation between how this tree reacts and how this next tree reacts. Yes or no, do you think that there's a correlation? All right, thanks, the point got across. Of course there's a correlation. And a correlation, of course, doesn't make it stronger, right? It just means that a lot of them might give a yes, even if it's wrong, but they're correlated, and hence they win here, and you get it wrong. What can we do about that? Well, not a lot in this approach. And I used to think that's a disaster for it. But actually, I've been surprised that boosted decision trees works really well. However, there are things to do, and that is what a random forest is. All right. The very notion of random made me suspicious, because I said there shouldn't be it. You should do the smartest thing. You shouldn't do something at random. But the point is quite good. Instead of having very correlated trees, because they had all information and all variables available, let's try to make trees that are not correlated by giving them not the same data and not the same variables. All right, so I'll get to technically how you do it on the next slide. But here we have a very simple data set, which are the numbers from 1 to 5 and the variables A, B, and C. And tree one, we do a random sampling in, but putting back the case after we've put it in. So actually it took case number one twice in this and not case number three. And we only gave it the feature variables A and B, not C. All right, then we make a tree out of that. And then tree number two, we random sample again. Here, all were available, but we gave it A and C instead. So this is not going to be the same as that. Well, they might be correlated because they have A in and they have a good overlap in the entries, but not as much. Tree number three, also got all of them, but now it's B and C. And tree number N got something else. It didn't have number two, nor event number five, and it had A and C. Now you make a forest of random trees which are not too correlated. So you say each tree should be powerful, but not all powerful. But when you combine them, it becomes really powerful. All right. And here's the specifics of how you do it. So let's say you have a training set with n samples, then you sample this at random, but you put replacements in. And also if you have n feature or input variables, then you choose a number small m, such that each node get the small m variables selected at random out of m total. And the value of M is typically held constant. And then you grow the trees to the largest extent possible. There's no pruning. What is pruning? Well, that is to say, look, whenever you go too far down in your tree, let's cut away some of the branches, leaves, to make the tree simpler. Now, they depend on two things, of course, because they depend on the correlation between two trees. And well, if you get more correlation, then you get higher error rates. So it's an attempt to minimize that. Of course, it also depends on the strength of each tree in the forest. If they're too weak, then you can't do anything with them. But you know, if each one has a reasonable lookout, then they work well together. And M is, well, one of the things that you have to find out yourself what is good here. But the great thing is that imagine that there are things in the problem with the housing which is modular, you know, it subdivides. Let's say location is one thing and the house itself is something else. And these two are not too correlated. Well, then whoever looks at location will get a good estimate of that, and whoever looks at the house itself gets a good estimate of that. And when they vote together, even if one is off, then the other one will to some extent save it. So this is a quite good way of working. And the number of features of random forests are many. So for quite a while, they were unexcelled in accuracy. So they were the most best at it, at least for a good class of problems. And they run efficiently on large data. They don't care if there are thousands of input variables. It's not a problem. Well, and you can read through all of this yourself. But that's why random forests have lately been, I would say, in vogue. And then I'm going to end off with I'm going to end off with a short story, and then we're going to have a discussion, and then we're certainly going to take a break. This is about one of the algorithms called XGBoost, which is a neat little story. So in 2014, following the discovery of the Higgs, we were looking into discovering it in a new decay mode, which is very hard. So we had some very, very large simulated data samples, which we then decided to put out on Kaggle. And we've used in particle physics machine learning for a long time, but now we wanted to see how others were doing, because this was sort of at the beginning of the revolution of machine learning. And this Higgs machine learning challenge broke all records on Kaggle by far for 2014. So there were 35,000 solutions coming in for this. And they were discussed in forums all over the place. And the data set was downloaded by, you know, an immense amount of people. It's become a standard data set used. And well, it turns out that one guy, a postdoc, Qianqi Chen, he made this XGBoost. He didn't win himself, but I think it was a third of the contestants who used it, and also the one guy who won second place actually used it. And so he was given a special award for this. And here's from Wikipedia on the history of it. And you can see, after winning the Higgs machine learning challenge, if you make it into top three in these Kaggle challenges with that many competitors, you're sure to have a good job in Silicon Valley afterwards. Well, then started being used, and it was translated into usage in Python and R, and suddenly it became a quite used algorithm. And in the ML links, I've linked the paper. You can also find it here. It's actually a quite readable paper. And a simple thing that he did was to say, well, I make a tree, but at the end, I also give scores. And so the score for that guy is what each tree sum up to be, not just a voting, but a scoring, right? And that was one thing he did. He also did something called an approximate way of splitting instead of an exact greedy algorithm, because it took, so it was much faster. And finally, here's the loss function. This is what I just showed you before. But he put in an extra term saying, if you get too complicated a tree, I will punish you. You know, don't overgrow it. And I think it's the scalability that really made XGBoost a fantastic one. It was so fast. And then you think, well, new algorithms see the light of day all the time, and every week, maybe even day. And so not long after XGBoost came out, a little while after though, LightGBM came around. And lo and behold, LightGBM was in some cases 10 times faster than XGBoost. What? How do they achieve that? Well, smart ideas. And LightGBM even came from Microsoft, the least expected place to get machine learning algorithms, I thought. But who am I to know? And I've put a link here, which is which algorithm takes the crown, LightGBM versus XGBoost. I also put it in the ML links. And it's a quite good discussion of the two, along with code examples. How to install, how to this and that. Finally, for all of this, here's a very good blog introducing tree-based learning. I sat and reviewed the books and the references we came with, but for tree-based learning, I actually think that this blog is the best so far. It fits this course and what we want to do the best. All right. So please go read that, apart from anything else or better. All right. I haven't read the chat now, but now let's open for questions and then have a long break. Please. Yeah, Christopher.
How are the weights supposed to be understood in the booster tree? Is that weights in the loss function or?
No, that's weights on the events. So in the first round, every event counts the same. Every entry counts the same. But in the next, some of these entries will have a higher weight, say weight 2, or might just be repeated, right? So now the cost of getting it wrong is twice as big. Yeah, Andy?
Yeah, so I was thinking about this XGBoost versus Light GBM. So one of the good things, in my opinion, with XGBoost is that it has been there a long time. Many people have used it, and there's a lot of helping packages for understanding the trees. What is the case with Light GBM? Is there also a lot of packages for that?
Thank you. I would say that there are generally a lot of packages for these. And the fun thing in machine learning is that old and well-tested is not necessarily good, because the field is developing so fast that 3 years old is to some extent too old. And some of the helping packages for understanding what goes on are general. They don't pertain to XGBoost necessarily, but also to many other things. So I would say XGBoost is fine to use. Yeah, Sophus might comment on that or something else.
I know, it's just like a meta question. So you have like, you gave us these three blocks, blog post and then also the chapter 5. Is there any like recommended reading order? Like, is one of them better to read before?
Yeah, this blog first.
Okay.
This blog first. That's also why I wrote out about it last night, and I'm going to repeat that. This blog first. It's simple, intuitive, good overview, everything.
Okay, so the two blogs, Lightverse BGM, and then the chapter 5.
Yeah, in fact, I would say the two blogs first.
Okay, thank you.
And chapter 5 and the books are actually generally more for an overall reference, you know, putting more math on it. But we decided that we wanted to keep too much math out of this course right away, because simply going through all of this in detail is too hard. I, of course, wanted to go through the log loss function because it's central, and we'll continue doing things like that. But the deep math will have to stay in the books. Yeah?
Hello?
Yeah, hi Sven.
Well, so I was wondering, just like the practical programming of these tree algorithms, can you, are there some examples in the blocks?
Yeah. Not in the main block that I had at the very bottom, but the XGBoost versus LightGBM has exactly the examples. And I can say almost typical for all of these are that you define capital X, your feature input, which is then a matrix, which is the size number of features and number of entries. So that's what you have to play with. And Y is the target, namely, should I get a 0 or 1 here, or should in regression, what value should I get? And you feed the two to the algorithm, and then you tell it with what options. And believe me, the options are many, right? These so-called hyperparameters, because they're not parameters in the model, right? They're not you know, where should I, what variable should I split on, and where should I split or weights in the neural network. They're rather, how deep should I allow the tree to be? How many entries should I request at the end? By what rule should I split? How many trees do you want? They're on the architecture and the development of the tree, not the details of the specific tree. And that's usually what is needed. And by the end of today, we have developed the simplest example for this. And now that I mentioned XGBoost and LightGBM, I should mention two others. The simplest one, I think, with the most documentation is based on scikit-learn. Scikit-learn, SKLearn, was an early package that included a lot of different algorithms. And they are well documented and they work fine and so on. And I think even XGBoost can be run from inside SKLearn, for example. However, if you really want to push it and you want to do the fastest possible, then doing it with packages themselves is the way forward. And then there's one called CatBoost, which is a new one also. I just want to mention for some. But otherwise, SKLearn, XGBoost, and LightGBM are what I think you should play with.
What about TensorFlow?
Yeah, TensorFlow is mainly for neural networks, I would say. So we will get to TensorFlow, and TensorFlow and PyTorch are the two ones for neural networks. Again, SKLearn works okay and has a normal forward neural network in it, whereas the others are more specialized and have things like convolutional neural networks and you know, a lot of other stuff in which tree-based algorithms can't even handle. Well, we'll get to that in the second half today.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions? You know what? If not, then I suggest we take a break until 10:35. And at 10:35, we'll start on the exercise. You're, of course, welcome to start before that. The exercise is to some extent, quite simple. Take Monday's data, the same as you read in earlier, and try to make a tree-based algorithm run on it. And yeah, see what the wrong fractions you can get out of that. As simple as that. All right, but let's reconvene in 16 minutes from now and take a long break, take some tea and coffee and relax and so on. Cool.
Trolls.
Yeah.
There are many people wanting to record the exercises. Will it be possible?
I will try. The problem is that when recording, I am afraid of overwriting the earlier recording with the lecture, which I think is probably the most important part. And the other thing is space issues. I'm discussing how much space I can take on the public pages. It should be okay. But let me just see. Vote yes, all of those who would really like the exercises to be recorded. All right. I can see that there's some public opinion behind it. All right, I'll do my best to do that. Okay. Yes, we'll end. See you in 15.